Hello, welcome to Wheat from the Chaff. I'm Finlow Costain, the chief editor of 8.9.com.
And I'm Phil Carson, the head of UK policy for the Nature Friendly Farming Network.
Later on, we're going to be joined by Heather Wildman, who's a Nuffield scholar who helps farming families and businesses deal with the thorny issue of succession. And I'm really excited to listen to what she has to say later. But first of all, as usual, we're going to explore some of the news stories that have come to our attention on the 8.9.com news website over the course of the last week. And the first story, Phil, that I have here is Scottish Forestry rejects the findings, or really it's the recommendations of the Royal Society of Edinburgh's tree report. Here we have the Royal Society of Edinburgh, which has published a report on the environmental and social impacts of public subsidies for the forest sector in Scotland. And in its recommendations, the report's calling for the Scottish Government to discontinue subsidies for coniferous commercial tree planting. It says that in discontinuing these subsidies, Scottish Government should redirect the money that's being saved towards tree planting that's designed to provide long-term carbon sequestration, biodiversity and public benefits. Scottish Forestry, of course, has pushed back, saying that a combination of both conifer and broadleaf trees is required to achieve these various different outcomes. And I guess the real thing that this raises is the role of public payments. And I know that you have some thoughts on this.
I don't disagree with Scottish Forestry that we need to have a mixture of a commercial timber industry and coniferous, I suppose, plantations to deliver certain objectives. And we need broadleaf woodland and increased plantation and focus on those to deliver a whole range of other ones. There's opportunity for both of those to kind of meet and deliver mutual kind of outcomes at the same time. But I think the question here really comes down to the justification for that spending and for that subsidy and whether it is trying to address a market failure and whether it is trying to provide a public good. And we've obviously seen within agriculture, it's been the debate that's been, I suppose, particularly live since we left the European Union, but it's been going on for quite some period of time. And that is that there is a market for food, there is a market for other goods produced from the land, and the state shouldn't necessarily be responsible for paying for those. There are other areas which there isn't a market developed, and I suppose there's market failure, and we need to invest to deliver some of those other kind of broader public goods. And I think this comes down, I suppose, the centre of this argument. And I think it is fair to question whether public money should be used to incentivize something of which you would get a market return for. But in saying so, there's a question of why that market isn't necessarily functioning as well as it could be at this point in time.
Now, you've connected already the whole world of forestry with the world of farming. I'm going to come back to the world of forestry. But first of all, I just want to pick up on that idea that food isn't a public good. Because I think a few years ago, even maybe a few months ago, I'd have been much more in the same camp as the way that you've just described it. That if we're thinking about public goods, then these are things for which there isn't a market. Food, there is a market, and therefore it shouldn't be considered a public good. However, there has been decades of disconnection between the costs of production and the cost of food, the disconnection between the type of food that's produced and the type of food that's eaten, the nutritional deficit in ultra-processed foods. And so it feels to me like maybe there is another conversation that we need to start having now, recognising the public value, the public good element of food, because there are so many people who are unwell as a result of ultra-processed food and poor diets. There are so many people living in poverty, of which food poverty is a part. And so maybe there is an argument for reconnecting those things and just recognising that food is a public good, regardless of whether it's something that the market can or should reward. And I guess that then brings us back to forestry. But before I do, just comment on that, would you?
Yeah. I think you raise legitimate arguments, and healthy, sustainable food is absolutely critical to delivering a range of, I suppose, delivering healthy people, which are so important for our economy, for society, for all of those sorts of things. And ultimately, what we eat underpins a lot of what we do. That said, how we deliver sustainable, healthy food is the kind of question within this. I think whenever we develop quite simple agricultural policies that recognise that food is a public good you see perverse outcomes coming out from that, or which state that food is a public good. And I would say food security is a public good, and we have to deliver that through a range, I suppose, of quite sophisticated policy interventions. I think there's a lot of risk in just saying that food production is a public good in its own right and can lead to a whole range of different unintended consequences. Does that answer that question?
Yeah, absolutely. And keeping in mind those two slightly different perspectives that we have on food and the degree to which it's a public good or otherwise, let's come back to forestry, because I think it helps to provide a window into this conversation, because it's, as you say, around the role of public payments and what they do. And if forestry is to support essential industries, I mean, yes, there's no doubt that timber and wood products are something that that the market should be rewarding, and the market does reward. However, there is such a deficit in terms of our own timber security when there is an increase in timber use around the world. And so is it justified for there to be a support for these essential industries? And then the second point that I'm going to make, and then please come back in again, is that if we are contributing public payments through taxation, if we, the citizens, are contributing those payments, then we have much greater capacity to be able to make demands on those industries, that these industries deliver in particular ways, whether that's related to the environment or carbon sequestration or whatever else.
Yeah. And I think I'm going to go back to food and look at it in that sense, first of all, and then we'll go back into forestry. We're playing quite an interesting game here, I suppose, in a way.
It's table tennis. Yes.
So from the food perspective, I suppose if we acknowledge that there isn't necessarily market failure, but there's a market which isn't necessarily functioning as efficiently or as effectively as it could be, and we need to identify what the problems or the issues are there and try and overcome those. And that would be, I suppose, through potentially regulating the market, or if we talk about supply chain fairness, for example, try and address those issues. If we're talking about access to food, that's not a question of producing more food or focusing on food production per se. It's about enabling people to be able to afford food and to be able to access the stuff that's healthy and sustainable, all those sorts of things. And I suppose the same principles kind of apply or could apply in the perspective of forestry. So why are we seeing challenges in terms of that market and it not necessarily reaching or attaining the opportunities that it could? And I don't know what the answers are there, but I think we need to have that look in terms of, is it that we don't have payments for them? Because we do have payments for them. There are forestry grant schemes, and yet still we are behind the level of planting that's required to meet net zero targets, timber targets, all those sorts of things. So we have a public money going into it. It's not necessarily working. So what are the other reasons which are holding that back? And I think that's where we come up with policy solutions to try and address those.
And I guess one of the questions that one has to answer is, what would happen if the payments were removed? And I think for me, it comes back to, if all you have is regulation, then what you're doing is trying to regulate against worst practice, effectively, that you can bring up the lowest cost common denominator, but it's much more difficult to appeal to the highest denominator. Whereas if you have public payments going in, then it's much more reasonable to invite commercial forestry to be much better at dealing with biodiversity, making sure that there are a greater number of conifer species within a particular plantation, to work on the water outcomes, to reduce flooding, etc., and to improve amenity values and access. And so I think that by providing, an element, and let's not pretend that it's a huge element, but by putting a relatively small amount of money into the timber industry, we can prevail upon them to deliver best practice.
Yeah, and here's a question. So say, for example, we have public investment going into forestry. There's potentially a case for that, but we have to then maybe look at, okay, what is that forestry ultimately? What's its end use? Do we only use public payments for commercial forestry, which meet certain criteria and then ultimately result in carbon being locked up for a long period of time? They're not going, say, for example, to bioenergy use, things like that. So is that a role to be brought into this so that there's more stringent things brought in place? Then you actually are ensuring that that public investment is delivering the outcomes of which the sector is saying it's trying to meet.
And that seemed to be a misunderstanding that the Royal Society of Edinburgh were possibly guilty of, in that they were thinking that there's something about commercial forestry where perhaps it's just going to paper, or it's just going to be burned as biofuels, where actually, you know, an awful lot of timber that's produced in the UK is being made into furniture or is being used for timber frame buildings. And of course, in Scotland, you have 80% of new builds are timber framed these days, as opposed to something much more like 20 or 30% in England and Wales. And that's very significant. And clearly, there is a need for Scottish timber to be used in Scottish building, if and where that's possible. Let's move on to number two, which is non-native sycamore is the third most common British tree. And this is a story that we had on the website last week, and also a TV interview with Chris de Gorne, who has just started his new nature recovery startup, Life to Land, which is aiming to help landowners and gardeners with 1 to 100 acres who want to improve their nature outcomes. And he created a detailed analysis using the National Biodiversity Network to find that the sycamore is the third most populous tree in the UK. And I guess this raises questions about why is that important? Native versus naturalisation. Many people would say that the sycamore has naturalised now, but it's still non-native. And why it's important, of course, is that it isn't supporting the level of biodiversity that that ancient British trees like the English oak and things like that, that they would be supporting. Was this story of interest to you, Phil?
It certainly was, and I think it raises lots of questions around what is better subjectively and objectively, I suppose, as well. And that's difficult to kind of determine sometimes. But yeah, even kind of the sycamore itself as a tree evokes, like, I suppose, quite important and kind of key memories for a lot of people. We all remember the kind of the helicopter dispersal method in terms of how the sycamore kind of spreads itself. And you can see just in terms of that why it's ended up as such a prolific species. I think one of the questions within this would be, or I suppose one of the interesting things is, how many people actually realise that sycamore isn't actually native to the UK, that it is a naturalised species and was, yeah, non-native and invasive as well. All sorts of questions on that front. Also, the question around invasives in the UK as well and their impact on biodiversity. And yeah, I suppose the general prevailing thought is that they are inherently bad. But I have seen certain commentators that question that somewhat, and kind of what role do they have in the 21st century? And I'm not saying I agree with that, but it's just interesting some of those other perspectives in there as well. So I think this piece pulls out a lot of those thoughts and questions.
And one of the things it does is to explain why the sycamore is a bit of a challenge. And of course, the issue is that it comes out much earlier than other trees. It has very large leaves that crowd out other species within the woodland, and therefore it's able to dominate much more rapidly. It has these really great big solar panels that stop other things from growing, which is why we see places like Wytham Woods, for example, really being taken over. And one of the things that Chris said that I thought was really interesting was that if you think of biodiversity interactions, possibly in terms of, you know, the way that we might think of our friends, and you have a friend that you've known for a few weeks and you know a fair bit about them, you've been out, you've had good, you know, good long chats perhaps, and you know what they're about, but the relationship that you have with that individual can't be anything like the relationship that you have with a close friend that you've known since the first day of primary school, where you've grown up together and you have all of that information. And so the sycamore effectively is giving you that kind of later friendship, that more peripheral friendship, if you like, where the ancient oaks are giving us something much more substantial.
Yeah, totally. And we spoke about this last week, I suppose, whenever we were having a conversation about this piece, and we were kind of saying, yeah, at what point do you draw the line? And we talked about Romans and rabbits and things like that as well. And yeah, I think that point that is made really in terms of the relationships between different species and how they interact within the ecosystem in which they're found is really key within this. Yeah, we talked about oak, all the above ground type of stuff, but then also the kind of soil ecosystem and things like that as well. If there's going to be relationships which have been established over thousands of years Of course, an invasive or a naturalized species is not going to have that level of interaction.
And of course, in terms of the rabbits that you mentioned there, I think it's something along the lines of only 1 in 10 rabbits actually lives till adulthood, because it's become such an important part of the food chain for so many larger predators within the UK. So there's a species that was introduced, albeit 2,000 years ago, but it's become really important. And I guess that's the way that we look at it, is what you said, isn't it? That we look at the individual species rather than just assuming that all non native species are inherently a bad thing. What's number three, Phil?
Number three is European Parliament votes to criminalise ecosystem destruction. And this piece focuses on the fact that the EU has become the first international body to criminalise the most serious cases of environmental damage that, in their words, are comparable to ecocide. So it focuses on ecosystem destruction, so that could be habitat loss, air pollution, impacts to water and soil. All of these sorts of, actions and consequences will be punished with tougher penalties and ultimately potentially prison sentences under the reformation of the EU's Environmental Crime Directive. So this went through to a vote in Parliament last week. And yeah, we saw a massive, overwhelmingly in favour of the changes to the legislation, with nearly 500 votes in favour, 100 against, and there was only 23 that abstained. So this directive, and my understanding of this is that it addresses issues in the past where environmental crime could have been undertaken in essence, or you could have seen massive environmental consequences if there was a permitting system in place which enabled that activity to move forward. This overrides that in a sense and says, if you cause, unforeseen or negative consequences as a result of your actions, then you will face ramifications as a result of that. So it's very, very interesting and could pave the way to, a more stringent environmental enforcement regime moving forward.
And importantly, I think this is a clear example, isn't it, of the EU now going further in terms of its environmental protections than the UK, which sort of brings us on to the fourth story as well.
Yeah, and this one, as you say, focuses just on that in particular, and it makes the point that UK government policy is both inconsistent and failing to deliver on farm antibiotic use. And it outlines how, after a lot of delay, we've brought through or have seen proposed new legislation to address prophylactic use of antibiotics on farms in the UK. But when looking at that, it actually finds out that these rules and this legislation is a backward step on EU legislation, which was brought into place in 2022. And although there are some positive measures and some positive parts within that, ultimately it falls short and is not going to compensate for poor hygiene or address inadequate animal husbandry, which are causing or driving the rates of use that we have at the moment. We have seen, and there has been commentary that the UK as a whole has reduced antibiotic use, but whenever that's compared to the likes of Denmark, the likes of France, other places like that, we're not seeing the consistent level of reductions as you are in other parts of Europe.
And I think one of the key messages associated with this is, it's not all farming that's using antibiotics routinely. It is the most industrialised models of farming. And so in particular, they're pulling out broilers and piglets and dairy cows. And if we think about broiler chickens just for a second, then the growth rate of broilers has quadrupled since the 1950s, and it's these fast-growing breeds in the most industrialised systems that are receiving 6 to 9 times the antibiotics per bird than slower-growing breeds are. And when it comes to pigs, we have the most productive UK sows now producing an average of 17 plus piglets a litter, 37, 38 live piglets a year, and it's the early weaning of these piglets and the post-weaning diarrhoea, which again is it's the routine use of antibiotics to try and prevent these problems, because we have these square pegs that we're trying to force into round holes. And if we think of the animals as being the square pegs, we keep trying to round the corners off the animals rather than recognising that we need circular pegs to go through circular holes. We need to adapt the farm system rather than the animal itself. And the other one there, of course, that I mentioned is the British dairy cows. And that's again about the genetic selection for high milk yield. All that energy going into of the udder, which is then causing other potential health and welfare problems, some of which are being treated with antibiotics. It's worth saying that the UK is so much better than it was a decade ago in terms of antibiotics, but there are places where the routine use is persistent.
And just to very quickly finish on this one, I think it points to some of the arguments that Rob Havard made in one of our previous podcasts. Whenever you're selecting or basing your kind of your genetic selection program on one outcome, which is improved productivity or improved yields or production, then you come into all sorts of unintended consequences, all sorts of problems that you then have to address through various different other means. And I think it's, yeah, your point there, we're trying to address problems that are emerging as a result of the systems that we've chosen and the outcomes that we prioritise within that.
Let me just introduce this final article before we go to a break, which is Food and Farming Policies Fettered by Neoliberal Economics, says the SDP. Now, I don't want to be rude, but receiving this news release, I hadn't realised that the SDP was still a thing. But having looked at their green paper, which is called Farms, Fields and Food, actually, there was some really good stuff in here. And what they've done is to identify some of the challenges in relation to food and farming and come up with quite a detailed paper with some solutions. There were two key reasons why they say attempts to change the UK's broken food system have never seriously been implemented. Firstly, they say governments have been too scared to challenge the narrative that all people want is cheap food and that they won't tolerate a nanny state telling them what to eat, which they say is nonsense. And secondly, other parties are fettered by neoliberal economic policies, which prevent any meaningful attempt to tackle the issue. Free trade and open labour markets have deterred investment in training and innovation, increased our reliance on an overextended global food supply chain, forced food producers to prioritise yield over sustainability, and sold swathes of our countryside into foreign ownership. What do you think, Phil?
Like you, I didn't realise the SDP were still about, so a little bit of surprise, but there's nothing within that that personally you couldn't really agree with. And I think a lot of what we're talking about today and the other news pieces are probably as a result or a direct result of a focus on the state withdrawing or trying to have as light touch an impact on the market as possible. So with that, we're seeing prophylactic antibiotic use because we don't want to regulate in that space. We are seeing this question around market failure and the lack of native woodland coming into play as well. And we're trying to address some of those problems too. And then also, the moves in the European Union around ecocide and trying to address some of the problems that have been caused by our current system. And some of those unintended consequences of all-out growth and very, very light hand of the state. So I think there's some legitimate arguments in there. I think the recommendations that they come out with the end of it in terms of affordable, healthy food and fair prices to producers, can't argue with that. Sustainable farming and environmental restoration, again, completely supportive of that. Thriving rural communities and a future for small farms, no problem with that at all. And then UK food security within, I suppose, a global market. Again, I think that's all to be applauded.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be fair, when we come to those specific recommendations that you mentioned there, I think that they're probably things that almost every political party could sign up to. The good stuff actually was in the rest of the report where they were, sort of talking through the issues. And I have to say, we've been calling, haven't we, over the last few weeks with the knowledge that there's a general election coming later on this year in the United Kingdom, for a political party to start joining the dots across food and farming. And the SDP, I would say, has delivered a pretty good first stab, and other parties could do a lot worse than get hold of this green paper and give it a read. Should we go to a break? And we're back and we're joined by Heather Wildman. Now, Heather, earlier on today, I described you fairly bluntly as somebody who helps farming families and businesses deal with the issue of succession. But I know that what you do is so much bigger than that. Could you tell us what you do?
Thank you. Yeah, it's awesome. I'm not very, very succinct in this, but I help people facilitate and navigate meetings, I mediate, and I help also with vision and goal setting. So my whole business, regardless of whether I'm just speaking one-to-one to a young farmer who's looking for some mentoring, some coaching, or whether it's a big corporate company that's looking to do some strategic work, is I always start, where are you, vision? Where do you want to be? How are we going to get you there? And then communication, how do we communicate that? What do we communicate? Who do we communicate it in? What format? How often? And then collaboration. Who do you need with you to achieve your dreams, goals and ambitions? Have you got the skill sets? And, you know, how do we get the right people there, the right ones on the right seats? So suddenly your dreams and goals are achieved much quicker and more often and more enjoyable.
Now, you deal pretty exclusively, I think, within agriculture, within the farming sector. Why for you is farming different from other jobs?
I love farming. I love the farming people, the personalities, the characters, the great that we do as an industry and as an organisation. But I think where we probably have weaknesses is that we don't separate the people and the person from the from business. So it's farming becomes its own entity, its own identity. It's like an innate object. It's like the third person in a room and everything. And it can make us lose our rational thinking and everything as well. And we're very good at farming, at working through solution, you know, work through problem. But we don't stop and think and plan and talk and bring the business side into it. Why are we actually doing what we're doing? Are we all on board? You know, what if we've got different needs and desires and beliefs and vision for the business? So that's why I come in and help people break down those barriers, start the conversation sooner, ideally before there's a fallout.
In your experience, Heather, how long of a process or a difficult of a process is that to entangle, I suppose, the entity of farming from the business side of it as well? I can imagine that brings, yeah, some pretty significant challenges because your unweaving culture, kind of family relationships, economics of it all. How do you do that?
Every family's different and you're starting from a very different starting point on every business. And a lot of the time it's how the handing down generation, what their experiences was, you know, if their first generation or they didn't get it till they were in their sort of 60s, 70s, often they hang on tighter. And it's my way. I'm in control. I don't want to be told how to do it. And they're reluctant at sharing and letting the next generation come in. Other times it can be, you know, some families are just fantastically good at communicating, sharing people through, and they just need some structure. They just need some sort of guidance on what should be asking, how they should be asking, how they formalise the communications and change the parent-child relationship to partners relationship and put some sort of structure and formality in that as well, so that then when they've got some disagreements at work or there's, you know, some difficult days and some challenges, that then gets parked, because it's not too many businesses that you work and then you go and have a meal with someone and then they do your washing and clearing up and everything, and you know you're living within 24 hours. So it's how you separate the parent child to partners and business and family.
Within that as well, there's all these other dynamics at play. So I suppose you would have previously said that kind of farmers were their own boss, but now you've also got government policy coming into place. You've got the supply chain, processors, all of those sorts of things which are difficult to navigate and to predict for as well, I think, in many cases. So how much of an impact have you seen that having on people's decision making within this as well?
Yeah, again, really broad. You've got the guys and girls that are involved in farming, that are involved in discussion groups, in business groups, that are very active on social media, that regularly attend different industry meetings and things as well. So they're pretty on the ball. They've got such a broad net of influence and communication coming through that they can see some of the reasons, the justifications, and they're pretty proactive. And already some of the restrictions and obligations that have been brought in, they're kind of already bringing a lot of that into their business. So it isn't such a huge constraint or driver. And then you've got the other sort of type of farming families that, you know, just leave us to farm the way we want to do it. This is how we've always done it. This is how we want to do it. This is what we're good at. This is what our land sets. And they can be, I'm feeling a lot of these businesses are getting tired. They're getting tired because the goalposts moving, the margins are getting tighter. It's quite lonely. It's quite tiring. A number of them are getting older as well. So their energy, you know, they've had this knock, they've gone through this change, they've gone through this challenge. And it's like, why are we doing it? So for some, I'm seeing now they're thinking, do you know what? This is maybe a good time for us to refocus, rethink, why are we doing this? Whether we get out, whether we sell up, whether we let the farm till the next generation's ready, or whether we retire and let the next generation come in, who might be really up for it, want to do something slightly different, and have got a whole new dream and ambition and vision for the business as well. So it's quite varied, really, but I do definitely see that there's a divide happening now between our farming families all over the UK and in all sectors now, that are just starting to think, hang on, what are we doing this for? Working longer hours, missing out on family, cutting back, not getting the investment they're wanting, and then not seeing public support and feeling they're just getting used as the stick all the time to keep changing, whereas they're not necessarily seeing the benefits and the returns for that.
Does part of this come down to power? Because farmers, you ought to have a lot more power, didn't they? I mean, they've got the land, they've got the opportunity, and yet they are so often beholden to the public or the bank or the processor or, you know, something else. And I wonder if part of that being able to sort of feel more in control, feel like they have a more resilient business, perhaps something that, you know, that younger generations want to come into, is about being able to take power back somehow.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think we all, you know, feel vulnerable when there's change, there's uncertainty, and we don't know the direction, and we feel there's a lot of things out of our control. And what I do say to a lot of clients is sometimes, you know, instead of getting your head bogged down, listening to all the negativity, because there's so much negativity in the press, in the news, in social media, and everything as well. So when I work with a client, one of the first things I do is actually sit down and write down everything that their asset worth is, you know, what the farm is, what the estate is, what the stock is, if they've got pension shares, if they've got diversifications, other interests, and just sort of park it there, letting them think about, you know, it hasn't been for nothing, you know, and a number of these businesses, you know, built up significant wealth, but then we can't miss out the debt. So we put in the debt and the borrowings and everything else as well, and we put in the ownership structure. And then we start thinking, right, well, what do you want to do? What do you want from this business? How many years do you still want to enjoy farming and to get a living from it? Can you retire and be financially independent? The next generation, you know, are you going to be farming full time? Are you going to have other income that's going to subsidize the farm? Because you want that difference. You want that going to work. You want the chat, the stimulation, but you also want that enjoyment of working and owning and living on the land and nurturing the soil. And I think there's so much myth now about the carbon value, and it's a bit sort of, again, carrot and stick, and it's a bit Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. There's not really a full understanding of what this is. And I think the turn has to come in, because none of these big corporate companies, none of all these big organizations or anything, we are the ones that has the soil and the land. And, you know, if we can find a way of working together and really utilizing and having some honesty and transparency of what that land is worth, and then we could sort of think of, okay, well, if we did a contract for 10 years that allows the children to do this, this would pay for my retirement, this would enable us to buy da-da-da-da-da. So we've got a bit more control, and we can use it as a sort of leeway and a bargaining and another budgetary tool going forward. So I think there is a fear of lack of control, but I think we've got to be careful we don't get spun. We've actually probably got a lot more control if we just stop, take a step back, and really start thinking, hang on, we have a value. We have a serious contribution to the social community, the economic community, the health and well-being of our population, and the economic stability of the country as well. Let's look at what bargaining power we have here, and then we need some informed people working together.
You've described two different scenarios, and I suppose a split between those who are really wondering what the future has for them and those that are able to kind of see what the opportunities are and are able to embrace them. there's a question in here, and we hear this all the time around kind of just transition and supporting that. And one of the things I often think about is the human element of the agriculture transition sufficient? And do you see a role for government to invest, say, for example, in more advice or business management advice? Do we have enough of that, or is that lacking?
Oh, my word. Farmers hate advice and advisors and consultants. We're the scourge of society and we are failed farmers. So I guess some quality advisors and consultants out there. And, you know, but that's the same in accountancy, land agent, lawyers, banks. You know, there's some fantastic business advisors out there that really understand the industry, the sector, the challenges, the opportunities and things as well that can make a huge difference to your business. So for me, the successful businesses, you need to look at who you've got around you. A network for me is everything. It's not what you know, it's who you know. So you need to be very, very clear in what you want. What is your vision, your dream or goal? Are you wanting to retire? Are you wanting to step out? You know, time out. I've done the rat race. I want to enjoy doing something different. I want to let the next generation in. Or are you someone coming in that's thinking, do you know what? I'm ready for this. I want to have a go, but I'm not sure where the market's going. I'm not sure whether I need to stay in dairy. I'm not sure whether I want to go regenerative, you know, all these different things. So for me, then it's about thinking, right, how do you associate yourself with the best? So who is a really good business person that is doing what you want to be doing? And then look at them for guidance, mentoring, supporting. See if they're in discussion groups. See if they're in, you know, if they're doing podcasts, if they would come and mentor you, if they would come and talk to you as well. And then get the best advisor that's in that sector as well. And then do your research on milk companies, on all these different contracts and things that's out there, on your genetics, on your soil, on your grass, and maybe pull some like-minded people together, because it is quite insular, it's quite lonely, and you will have bad days and you'll get a wobble. And so often we're nervous of trying something different to maybe what our families or neighbours have done, because what will they think? And what if we fail? Whereas if you've suddenly got a really good, strong support team and things aren't just going right, or you're just getting a bit of a wobble of confidence, or there's a news about this, you can say, right, what are you thinking? What are you doing? Have you changed your reseeding? Are you going to mow now? Or are you going to hold? You know, so it gives you, you're not alone in these decisions, and collaboration, and more people want to work with you as well. And it kind of grows and grows, these successful organizations that can just start with one or two like-minded people that are in the pub, fed up, having a beer and a chat, and say, well, I'm interested in that too. Let's get together.
I think you started to answer this, but I just wanted to sort of come in with this last question, which is around the idea of working together. And you talked a lot about sort of repairing and sort of helping with communications inside the family. And I'm interested in those communications, not just inside, but outside and in sort of a broader community, whether that community ends up being national or more local, sort of within the landscape area. And farmers have always sort of thought of themselves as independent business people, running independent businesses. But I wonder how much scope there is for actually working more closely together, particularly to unlock some of that power in the land around things like carbon markets, natural capital markets. And I'm always struck by the way that farmers are fantastic at looking over the hedge and seeing what their neighbours are doing, and then often following that. And of course, over the last few years, we've seen this enormous surge in the use of social media and an incredible learning process that's taken place, particularly around things like regenerative agriculture, where WhatsApp and Twitter has really enabled that conversation to take place. And I wonder if there is the scope, in your view, from the conversations that you've had with farmers, to start more actively encouraging farmers to work together, to pool their resources, to pool their skills in order to be able to access these new markets.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's quite a lot of these groups and clusters that are coming together now, whether it be looking at water, environment, wilding, regenerative grazing, share farming. You know, that there is a number of this coming together. You know, some of my experiences have been like trying to get farmers to collaborate and work together has been like herding cats. You know, that they all say, yeah, or, you know, where they're great and good. And then if they think they can get a better deal elsewhere, or they can undercut someone, they're way down that road, and you're like, You know, so much for this. I think there is, but it's about really making sure your values are aligned. So I think where there's a real strong agreed reason for being involved in this collaborative group, and that the aims and objectives were all bought into, we've got very similar, the culture's right for us, and we don't tolerate, if we're in, we're in, we support each other and we have each other's back. I think there's a lot of strength and there is an opportunity, but it's been very true to why you're doing it, and pick and choose people carefully. Don't just accept everybody as well, and that everyone has a bit of an investment. There's a real clarity of why we're there. Book have come with solutions. They're invested in it. They're bought into it. And I think these can work really, really well. But because I do think we have to get our voice stronger.
Fantastic. Heather, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us. Heather Wildman, who can be found at Saviour Associates. Thanks very much. Let's go to a break. And we're back. And Phil, just before we go on, thanks so much for suggesting Heather Wildman as a guest. I thought she was fantastic. Now, just taking us to the end of this week's programme, your organisation, the Nature Friendly Farming Network, brought out its own 5-point plan to try and heal some of the ills and the woes in Welsh agriculture. And I wonder if you could take us through that a little bit.
Yes, of course, Phil. So, obviously, we have discussed this at length throughout the last few weeks. At the moment in Wales, we have a consultation that's live on their sustainable farming scheme, which will be the replacement for the BPS. And yeah, there's been a fair bit of commentary on the good elements of that, the elements that aren't so good. And yeah, there's been a lot of misinformation and I suppose anger swirling around with this as well. And we are obviously responding to the consultation as an organisation, and we'll be feeding in our views. But we also wanted to put those out there to the wider sector, and I suppose the public as well, to demonstrate what we believe is required to deliver a good sustainable farming scheme, which delivers for farmers, but also delivers a lot of the outcomes which are increasingly going to be expected of farmers themselves over the coming years.
So Phil, one of the big contentious issues was this 10% of land being put into woodland, 10% for nature. What's your solution on that?
So from our perspective, we've made it very clear that we want to see the principle of right tree in the right place for the right purpose being employed within the scheme itself. So making sure that where woodland is going to be planted is doing the right things and isn't resulting in perverse consequences. From our perspective, we see that there's a need for communication here. I think that question around the 10% has become, I suppose, very, very contentious, it's brought out quite a lot of anger, and it's challenging. But whenever we look at it in the context of the vast majority of farms in Wales are already sitting at around 6-7% woodland cover, it maybe eases things a little bit. But from our perspective, we're also looking at what other sorts of interventions could be delivered potentially without that kind of blanket 10% requirement. So, for example, is there an opportunity for a tiered approach in which the further you are away, for example, from the 10%, you're kind of supported along the way to kind of rise up over time? Is there a way to do that? Is there a way to try and focus on woodland expansion in areas where that is going to be most optimum from a climate perspective? It's going to have the least impact on productivity, on farm profitability, all those sorts of questions as well. Is there a need for something more refined? So we'll be feeding in some thoughts on that front. But I think that principle that we put there in our five key asks is really key. On top of that as well, we want to see a proper funding package pulled together for the scheme. The scheme could try and deliver all sorts of things, but if it's not funded properly, then we're not going to deliver the outcomes that we want. We also want to see a further rollout of the collaborative and optional elements of the scheme as well. And those are the schemes and the payments which are going to support those farmers that have already delivered a huge amount for nature-friendly farming in Wales, and those which are managing some of those landscapes where you have large areas of priority habitat, which is going to be absolutely crucial for nature, for climate, and is also in quite often areas where food production is is less profitable in many cases as well. So we really want to see assurances that those elements of the scheme will be rolled out as a matter of urgency. We also want to see...
Just before we go on to those final bullet points, I'm interested in this this idea that of assurances that no farmer should be left behind. Do we really mean that? Doesn't there need to be an opportunity for some farmers to be able to opt out, to say we've had enough and to get out and make way for a different generation?
Yeah, I think it's a valid point. The key question within this is whether people are able to make informed decisions based on all of the right stuff that's available to them. And from our perspective, the way the scheme is set out at the moment, there's a large number of farmers that are managing very important landscapes, are reliant, or not necessarily reliant, but schemes that really support that level of ambition and those types of landscapes have been very, very important to them and have been an important element of business planning. And to not have those in place when the rest of the scheme coming in is a letdown. But of course, there'll be farmers that look at what's available and they might consider whether it's time to think about something else or it's time to retire. And that's legitimate, but it's having the full element and the full package of everything there to be able to make those decisions is crucial.
I interrupted you. Let's just bring us to the end of your asks.
So the fourth and fifth ones, we need to also have schemes that focus on the delivery of outcomes and not necessarily prescriptions. And this is obviously challenging in some respects whenever you've got a scheme which is trying to apply to everyone. But I think particularly in those optional and collaborative elements, there's potentially the role for payments by results, for example, a lot more flexibility in terms of the management as well, which would be quite key for certain things.
Tell me what you mean by outcomes, because, that payment by results, those payments by results could be via inputs or outcomes. And just planting a hedge is just the input. It's what that hedge is there to achieve. That's the outcome.
Well, I think it's the quality. It's the quality. You could have a hedge that's planted and it's been planted, but it's not delivering what you want it to because it's not being managed. Managed right. If you have an outcome which is focused on condition and quality and all those sorts of things, that's your outcome. And that's whenever you're going to draw down more carbon, you're going to support more biodiversity. That's what we mean whenever we focus on that. And within that, there's flexibility. There should be flexibility to manage within certain parameters, but manage in a way which is going to deliver those outcomes. And I think in the past, we've seen agri-environment schemes which have erred too much on the side of prescription and less on the side of outcomes and flexibility within that. So that is a big call within this. And then the last one, and it points to some of the conversations that we had with Heather, we need to have the people element of the transition within this. There's no point in having an online training course to deliver a lot of the asks within a scheme. This is going to be new stuff for many, and we need to see that investment in advice, proper support and guidance at a farm level to actually integrate environment and climate outcomes into the centre of your business.
Phil, anything else on policy this week?
Yes, events of note. So on Tuesday, we have a Westminster Hall debate, which is focusing on the reauthorisation of neonicotinoids, I suppose the emergency reauthorisation of those for sugar beet. So this is the debate on the environmental impact of neonicotinoids and other pesticides, and that's taking place on Tuesday when some of you might be listening, so it's worth having a look at that live or looking at the Hansard as well. And then this week we also have a general debate on farming following the back of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's announcement at the NFU conference.
Thanks very much. And just before we go, Phil, I must say I do like your jumper, but it does look quite pessimistic to me. We've had months and months and months of rain and you're wearing the symbol for a thunderstorm as if you're sort of calling up to the sky gods to give us even more rain. Surely that can't be your intention.
I have an electrifying presence. That's what I'm trying to get at there.
It's a cloud and a thunderbolt. Yeah, absolutely. Or lightning bolt, I should say. Brilliant. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the programme. Thanks very much for listening. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.
And I've been Phil Carson. Goodbye.